Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to Nobody Told Me. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
And we are thrilled to welcome Adrian Brodeur to our episode this time. Adrian is the author of the highly acclaimed new memoir entitled Wild Game, My Mother, Her Lover, and Me. It's a mother-daughter story unlike most other mother-daughter stories, and it's a real page-turner. As a mother-daughter duo ourselves, we found it fascinating, and we think our listeners will too.
Adrian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of your podcast, and I'm really thrilled to be on it.
Oh, well, we're so happy to have you. This story has been simmering in your life since you were 14, and it's a really fascinating story. Can you tell us how it all began?
Yes, absolutely. So my story began on a hot July night on Cape Cod in about 1980, and I was 14 years old, and I was alone in my bedroom, you know, mostly asleep, half asleep, a little bit thinking about a boy, but mostly asleep. And at some point, well after midnight, my door opened and my mother, whose name is Malabar, came in and she tried to wake me up. And she said, Rennie, which is my nickname, wake up, I need you. And I remember so clearly not wanting to be awakened. And then she said, Ben Souther just kissed me. And with that, of course, my eyes popped open. Because Ben Souther was my stepfather's best friend, and Ben Souther was married, which, of course, my mother was married, and they were couple friends. And although I didn't know it in the moment, my mother was about to embark on this epic, epic love affair that would last over a dozen years. But what I did know, even in real time, in that moment, that it was one of those moments in life with a before and after, and nothing would ever be the same. Mm-hmm. And so I'd gone to bed as my mother's daughter, but I woke up the next day as her confidant and best friend.
How did that feel as a teenager hearing this from your mother? It must have been really confusing, I would think.
Well, you would think that. And I think the other thing you might think is, you know, the obvious, which is like what an unbelievable burden to put on a child and how horrible. And to that, I would say, you know, especially with hindsight, yes, yes, and yes. But in truth, the experience in that moment was quite the opposite. I mean, it was, you know, you're so in your mother's thrall at that age. And my mother was this incredibly charismatic, fabulous woman. And it was really one of the most seductive, exciting, magical moments of my life. And I felt like once I climbed on board, which I really didn't have a choice in, but it was just like a very long adrenaline rush. It was like some, you know, mother-daughter version of Thelma and Louise. And I was the girl behind the wheel of the getaway car. And, you know, I was just always ready to jump on the gas when my mother came. But it was incredibly thrilling to be so close to her and to be such a part of a grown-up drama. And I think it was also, frankly, made, I don't know if it would have been different had she still been married to my father. I mean, she'd been, you know, it was my stepfather. She was confiding in me. It all seemed, you know, at that moment, certainly not afterwards, but very exciting.
What was your relationship like with her before she told you this big secret? Were you guys friends before, or was it more of, like you said, a mother-daughter vibe?
I think we had, you know, a more traditional mother-daughter relationship. That said, you know, we had had a confusing childhood. I mean, our parents got divorced. There were new people coming and going. But this was a decidedly huge change. I mean, she was always, you know, there is no black and white, right? You know, we're all shades of gray. And one of my big hopes in writing this book was to portray her well, you know, to show her complexities. And she was nurturing and she did have very sweet moments. And clearly she was also, you know, very narcissistic and put herself first. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't all one thing or the other.
And in some ways, you talked just a moment ago about being caught up in this grown-up drama. So for a 14-year-old girl, it must have kind of felt like she was accepting you. She was bringing you into this secret world that, you know, of the adults that heretofore you hadn't been a part of.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and also it sort of diverted me from my own complicated adolescence and puberty and separation and everything else. I just sort of went all in instead of doing what most of the teenagers around me were doing, which is sort of pulling back.
So you decided to facilitate that affair just because you really wanted to continue that relationship with her and you liked the role that you were playing now as her friend?
Well, you know, to say decided almost gives me more power than I think I deserved at the time. I mean, yes, obviously it was a decision, but I just think it's
But
so
you kind of didn't have a choice.
I don't feel like I did have a choice. And it's in this coincidence of all coincidences, or maybe not, my own daughter is turning 14 next week. So she's the exact age that I was when all this was happening in my life. And I mean, I can't even imagine, obviously, doing something like that. But I also can't imagine there would be many things that she would say, oh, no, Mom, I can't do that. You know, I mean, children want to please their parents. And I was definitely by nature a people pleaser. And by nurture, you know, the result of my parents' acrimonious divorce when I was young, you know, I had these abandonment issues. I just, you know, I was a barnacle and she was my rock.
How did this impact your own parenting style with your daughter over the years?
Well, I mean, gosh, you know, that's such a huge a huge question. But I think, you know, I did a lot of, first of all, I had my daughter when I was, you know, older, and I was not a young mother. But I think I've always been very clear on our boundaries, and I love my daughter, but I am her mother, and I do not try to be her best friend, and I put her well-being sort of above all else. You know, that's my number one priority. So, you know, we don't actually generally tend to make exactly the same mistakes that our parents do. But I can see why some people want a different relationship or want an even closer relationship. And I always respect these things, like these boundaries that she puts up. She'll suddenly, you know, I'll ask her about a friend or something and she'll say, oh, you know, well, that's, you know, I can't say, or that's private or something. And my own mother would have leaned in and been like, let it go. And I would have. I would have been, okay, well, what Julie did was. Yeah. You know? And I respect those boundaries. But I don't know if I would have had I not sort of had the experience of my past that I did.
How did you and your mom overcome challenges that obviously arose during this whole experience?
Well, I mean, talking about 30 years. So, I mean, the challenges have been different and progressive and changing all the time. So, you know, in the book, I describe many times of trying to separate a bit and successfully or unsuccessfully. And I think it will be, honestly, my lifelong challenge. I think I'll be having these conversations in my head with my mother long after she's gone. She's currently very ill with dementia. So we have an entirely different relationship now than we used to, for all the obvious reasons. But I will say she was, you know, she knew when I was starting to write this book and she gave her support. And I've, you know, I read a lot of it to her as she was getting sicker. But I will say, I think a big part of her enjoyed the pages. I mean, enjoyed hearing about the food and enjoyed listening to a time in her life when she had a lot of power. You know, she's fairly powerless now and relies on other people for almost everything in her life. So, you know, we remain close. It's obviously very different than it ever was.
I'm wondering, does your own daughter know the story now? I mean, this is going to be a huge book. It's going to be a movie as well, as I understand it. Does your daughter know?
Well, I have told her the essence of the story. I think it's a question I get asked a lot. And I think what sort of charming or funny about it is sort of the assumption that most of our children are that fascinated by our interior lives, because she is a very normal 14-year-old, and she is really interested in her own life, and I have left the arc of the book out and about, and every now and then she picks it up, but it certainly holds nothing to Rick Riordan or the book she enjoys reading. I don't think she's read the whole thing, but she does know the story, and she has a really nice relationship with her grandmother. But she, you know, I think it's just sort of in a place that doesn't affect her on the day-to-day. And my son is younger. He's turning 11, and, you know, he's really not remotely interested. But both my parents were writers, but my father was a writer with, you know, many books, and I didn't read them till I was an adult for the most part.
Going back to her story, talk to us a little bit about her relationships with Ben and Charles and what you thought the benefits and drawbacks were to each, because they were just fascinating characters.
Well, one of the most interesting things in writing this book was, frankly, how much empathy I developed for my mother. I mean, like a public service announcement, my heart expanded from going through this process and from writing this memoir, because during the writing of the book, I think the need to forgive her took a backseat to the need to understand her. And so my mother had a really difficult life. It might have seemed glamorous on the outside, but, you know, her parents were married and divorced and married and divorced to each other. Just so she went through two divorces of her own parents. And she had many tragedies. You know, she found out her father had a secret second family. She had an unhappy marriage to my father. She lost her first child. So the first time, you know, when she fell in love with my first stepfather, the Charles character, mm-hmm. I mean, I think she was madly, madly in love. And this was sort of going to be the great thing of her life. And of course, he had 4 strokes in 5 days, just a short while before they were to marry. And so, you know, she was probably in her late 40s at the time. And I think this was completely devastating. And so he became pretty much an old man overnight. And then, you know, Ben came into her life. And so on the one hand, we can talk about all that's terrible and wrong about that. On the other hand, you can kind of think, wow, this woman didn't curl up into a ball. She went for love. And Ben was this incredibly vibrant, vital, masculine man who hunted and fished and did everything outside and also was a businessman. And, you know, he was a really interesting character, and his wife, like her husband, was ill, and, you know, they chose to go that path.
At what point did you start to think that this might make a good story to write? I mean, you were 14 when it started, when your mother's affair started. It lasted for a dozen years. At what point did you think, hey, this could be a good story?
Huh, that's an interesting question. I don't think even when I wrote the memoir, I thought this is a good story. I mean, you know, when I first started writing about it in my journal, it takes a long time to become conscious about something. And I think one of the interesting things about memoir is you don't really get points for the tragedy, right? I mean, it's mm-hmm. about the mm-hmm. consciousness about the tragedy, or, I mean, tragedy isn't even the right word. You have to get consciousness about or perspective on your life's events. And for me, that took a long time. So, you know, I wrote about it in my journal as a teenager. I wrote really overwrought short stories in my 20s. They were fiction, but, you know, thinly veiled. And then I really, for a long period of my life, I dealt with it in humor. And by that, I mean also just in, like, cocktail patter. You know, it was like, ha, 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 you know, your mother, well, mine did this. You know? But I think it was all really a way to mask the, you know, fairly genuine pain I'd gone through, the things I'd done, the feelings of shame, all those types of things. And then, so I think really the changing point for me, or the moment when I realized I needed to look at my life differently, and, you know, I can't say that I started to think about writing it then, was when I had my own children and I realized, like, I, you know, there was a lot more to reckon with, and I did not want to mother as I'd been mothered. I knew that I just needed to face it head on. And because I am a writer, I, you know, that meant at some point taking it on as memoir, which is what I did. But, you know, even as I wrote, you know, the sort of, you know, I was as surprised as, you know, anyone would be that it struck such a nerve. I mean, I wrote a very specific and singular story. I thought it was good. I was, you know, writing in the wee hours of the morning, which was the only time I had to myself. And I felt a little crazy, you know, as I was sort of allocating this time when I was a working mother of two children. It's not like I had tons of it. And yet I found myself compelled to get up at 4:30 or 5 in the morning and write for a couple hours before my family got up. And then, you know, it was kind of thrilling, of course, to understand that, of course, the specific is universal. And we all have mothers, and mothers have an incredible amount of power over us, and it's often a fraught relationship. So even if you didn't abet your mother in her adulterous affair, you might be able to relate to big parts of the power she had over you as a young as a young woman.
Mm-hmm. Do you look back now, knowing how it's turned out, do you look back and regret the night that you agreed to be her confidant, or how do you feel?
You know, it's kind of just not in my nature to regret that way. And part of that is, like, I think I'm superstitious that if that night didn't happen, kind of like the Sliding Doors movie, like nothing else in my life might have been the same.
You wouldn't have your kids.
I wouldn't have these two children. I wouldn't have met my incredibly wonderful husband. I wouldn't have the friends I have, or possibly found literature in the way I found it, because all these things sort of, I don't know. I don't think about regret that way. I mean, I don't feel regret for the moments of my life.
You mentioned that your mother has dementia now, but before that, did she express any regrets or any thoughts about involving you in this cover-up of her affair?
You know, we spoke about it plenty in our lifetime together, and I just don't think she saw it quite that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think later on, given some of our bigger rifts and times of estrangement and so on, yes, I do think she regretted it. I don't feel like we ever had a big moment of, oh, honey, I'm so sorry, I should never have done that. I think, you know, she might have the same attitude about regret that I do. I think she did it. You know, it's really hard for me to sort of imagine what she was thinking. So I think I'm waffling a bit, because it's hard always to put yourself in someone else's shoes. But I don't think she felt like she needed a lot of forgiveness for it, which might sound terrible, but I don't think that's how she thought about it.
But you know what I love about the book is I feel like it's such an honest take on mothers, because I went through this long stage in my life where I felt like my mom was perfect, and I still think she's great, but I know she's a real person. And I think that your book really portrayed a parent as a person, and I think that's just fabulous, because people don't really do that. You do go through a lot of your life thinking that your mom is superhuman.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. There was one line that I read. I don't know if you guys read Vivian Gornick, but she had this book called The Situation and the Story, which is really about writing nonfiction, about writing memoir. And I think it was in relationship to Mommy Dearest, but she was sort of saying how, like, it never works to do these all black and white things. And there was this line that she wrote that I literally taped to my computer screen early on in the process, which was, "For the drama to deepen, we must see the loneliness of the monster and the cunning of the innocent."
Mm.
And I remember just thinking, look at yourself too in all of this. What was my role? And that's what I really tried to do in the book. I mean, obviously, it's very easy to sort of point a finger at my mother, who should never have woken me up. I mean, who should never have involved me. What she does with her own life is one thing, but to involve me and the way in which I was so involved. But at some point, you know, I stepped in. You know, I had opportunities to lean back, and somehow I was so embroiled. So I really wanted to look at that. Why was I doing that? What was in it for me, and why did it take me quite as long to kind of untangle this really confusing situation I was in?
I'm wondering how it impacted you from an emotional standpoint to go through all of this again and write about it. Did it help you put it all into perspective? Was it hard? Was it something you couldn't have done until the time you actually tackled it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if the writing of it was particularly much more cathartic than the processing the whole time. I mean, it definitely actually, the book itself came out fairly quickly. Like, I didn't struggle endlessly. I mean, it was a lot of work, but I didn't, you know, have big periods of block or big periods of, you know, emotional drama about it. It was like I'd spent 30 years trying to figure this out. And so it sort of came out reasonably quickly. And as I said before, sort of being able to empathize with my mother or see her in a little bit of a different way, it allowed me, you know, to forgive her. And I would say, like, forgive her in a way that felt really empowering. I think I used to think that forgiveness was something you kind of gave to someone else or bestowed upon them, and that it felt a little sacrificial or something. But this wasn't like that. I mean, forgiving my mother was less about sort of covering over her transgressions than a way to get out from under them. And it felt like this kind of radical act of empowerment and self-interest. And it unburdened me a bit from the past and helped me to forgive myself and just move on and become a better parent to my children, I think. I hope.
What advice do you have for people who might be listening who have written books and tried to self-publish and they haven't been the success stories they thought they would be, or for people who want to write books and want them to be success stories and want them to get the critical acclaim that your book has gotten?
What's the question again? What's the advice?
Yes.
You know, I have been in publishing for much of my adult life, and I don't think there is, I mean, I hate to say it, I don't think there is a piece of advice for that. In some way, I don't think that's, it sounds obnoxious, but I don't think that's the thing to want. I mean, I mm-hmm. think, you know, wanting the success is just the tail wagging the dog. What you need to do is want to write from a place of truth and a place of beauty and all those things. And honestly, my advice to any writer is, like, read a lot, internalize. You know, the advice I would give are a million steps before how to be successful, because it's just so much bigger than that somehow. And honestly, there are also wonderful, perfect, fabulous books that don't get the fairy dust. I mean, I'm not quite sure why some are sprinkled like this, and I'm very grateful, obviously, that it appears to be happening to my book. I mean, it's not out yet, so I can't really say that. But, you know, it struck a nerve, clearly, and that wasn't my intended that wasn't my intended outcome as I wrote it. I wasn't thinking, well, I hope this sells for a lot of money and everyone, you know, responds well. It's just I wrote it because I needed to write it.
And I'm wondering, too, how did living this story affect your decision to get into publishing and to become an editor and a writer?
That living the story had much to do with that decision. I mean, I was from, you know, I have this sort of literary heritage. My father was a New Yorker writer. My mother started life as a journalist and became a food and travel writer. So it was definitely part of my growing up. And I think as a result, I almost, you know, shunned it, as we do what our parents do. I was not interested in becoming like them in any way. So I had, you know, went into public policy when I got out of college. I got my graduate degree in it. I was really proceeding in a different way. And honestly, part of it is I wasn't a huge reader as a child. I mean, I read and I was smart and went to good schools and all the rest. You know, I was never one of those kids who was under the bed, you know, under the, mm-hmm. the blankets with the flashlight ever. And my father's third wife was this just extraordinary woman who had this beautiful independent bookstore in Del Mar, California. And from the moment I met her, which was probably in my early 20s, she just started pressing novels into my hands. And I think she changed my life. I mean, I became a reader through her, and reading certainly helped me almost more than any other thing understand myself, understand my story. You know, we're all so trapped in the bubble of our own experiences, and you cannot help when you read or when you write, but when you read, whether it's, you know, fictional characters or non-fictional characters, you are entering someone else's world. And in order to do that, you have to be imagining a life that's very different of your own. So whether it's about the Queen of England or, you know, a colored person in South Africa or a victim of violence in New Orleans, you know, these are all just other than our own worlds. So I think my stepmother really changed my life in that way by introducing me. And I remember distinctly after getting this graduate degree in public policy one day just thinking, wow, and there are no longer any policy journals on my bedstand. There are all these literary journals and novels and, you know, just making this pivot at some point when I got the promotion I was waiting to get and I realized, I'm on my way to becoming a bureaucrat and this is not the life I want. And so I changed everything and I had a pretty nice career in my early life in politics and public policy. And I just dropped every rung on the ladder and became an intern at a literary magazine in New York.
Wow. What authors would you say inspired you?
Oh, so many authors have inspired me. Let me just think for a second. I mean, in terms of memoir in particular, you know, I've mentioned that I love Vivian Gornick. I'm actually just grieving the death of my friend George Hodgman, who wrote a beautiful and nuanced mother-son memoir called Bettyville. I love Mary Carr's voice almost beyond reason. Catherine Harrison's The Kiss was no doubt. I mean, my mother had a different kiss, but it was an influential book, to say the least. And I also like a dip into poetry regularly for inspiration. I mean, just for language. But I read broadly. I mean, I like a good thriller, too. I just love books.
What do you hope your readers take from the story?
Yeah, you know, it would be a beautiful and unexpected thing if this helped people in their own lives, the way other books help me, if it helped them process and figure out some piece of their past or find greater peace in their own life, you know, that would be magical.
And as you know, our show is called Nobody Told Me. And so we always ask our guests at the end of the show, what is your Nobody Told Me lesson? So what is it that you wish somebody had told you about writing or life or a mother-daughter relationship that you wish that they had and would have saved you a lot of heartache?
Oh my gosh, I feel like nobody told me much of anything. How many answers do I get? I mean, it's so funny because I was thinking about this when I listened to your Mitch Albom interview.
Oh,
and
we love
about
him.
Losing all those wise people. And
yeah.
I thought, where were they? Where were my wise people? And it's not that I haven't had any, but wisdom wasn't a big thing that was passed down in my family. And I feel like I learned a lot about what not to do from my mother in some ways. And don't get me wrong, I love my family. They just weren't big on life's lessons or that type of thing. So I think what I wish I'd known that nobody told me was that keeping a secret could be so corrosive and destructive. Mm-hmm. And I think because it actually keeps you from being seen and known and being able to be loved for who you are. And so it really wasn't until, you know, there were so many turning points in my life, but until I started walking towards the light and realizing I wanted to be transparent and realizing I wanted my relationships to be transparent and different from those that I didn't want to hide things from people that I loved, that I could have the type of friendships and loving relationships that I do today. And I value honesty so much.
And Adrian, how can people connect with you on social media and the internet?
Well, I have a website, www.adrianbroder.com, and I'm on Instagram and Facebook. And I have to say, I'm not a big tweeter, although I have a Twitter account. It's something I keep thinking I should do, but I don't.
I'm the same way. I have an account, and I've never tweeted.
Right? It's kind of daunting.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't agree with that. But I have one for Nobody Told Me. I guess personally, I don't have one.
Yeah, Laura handles that for us. But okay, so your website is probably the best place for people to go.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, super. Adrian, this has just been a wonderful conversation. We just have loved talking with you.
We're so excited for the impending success of the book.
It's going to be, obviously, it's going to be a blockbuster.
Thank you. I hope you're right. I really appreciate it.
Our thanks to Adrian Brodeur. Again, she is the author of the highly acclaimed new memoir entitled Wild Game, My Mother, Her Lover, and Me. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
You're listening to Nobody Told Me. Thank you so much for joining us.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.